Mr. Jeremy Foster, to talk about the Metro design
language.
Mike, have a good afternoon.
Test. Everybody hear me? Okay, I'm back. It's time to change your hat, though. I was thinking about actually bringing a developer hat, designer hat, but I figured I may have offended enough people with a t-shirt illustration already, so let's just say it's time to change our hats. It's time to take off your developer hat and put on your designer hat, because we're going to be talking about using the Metro Design Language, okay? We call it the Metro Design Language because it really is. It's a language in and of itself. Your application is developed in a programming language like C# or JavaScript, but it's designed in a design language. Okay, so when I say design, especially you guys being developers, they don't want you to just kind of tune out. I know it's a tendency of developers just kind of throw up your hand and be like, that is somebody else's job. I'm not a designer, right? Well, don't think just about graphic design. Think about graphic design, architectural design. Really, I want you to think about user experience design. Because again, it is your job as the developer to make sure that the user has a delightful experience. That is the number one metric in the success of your application. The user experience, all right? Now, it has never been advisable to jump right into application development without first going through a really deliberate and thorough design process. Now, with Metro applications, it's all the more critical. It's really important. In fact, a lot of Metro's power comes from the consistency of its design principles. Okay, so I'm going to show you 8 traits of a well-designed Metro application, and then I'm going to step you through the whole design scenario for an application called Food with Friends, an app that we're going to use to find what restaurants our friend wants to eat at tonight and suggest restaurants of our own, and then finally come to a conclusion as to where we want to eat. So these are... that's the wrong slide. Apologize. These are the 8 traits of a well-designed Metro application, okay? A well-designed Metro application, first of all, follows the Metro style design. That one's pretty encapsulating. There's going to be a lot to it. We'll look at that soon. But your Metro style app should be fast and fluid. It should snap and scale beautifully. You want to make sure that you use the right contracts. You always want to make sure that you invest in a good tile, and you also use notifications to make your user feel connected and alive. You roam the user's preferences and the user's tasks even to the cloud. And finally, you embrace the Metro principles. Sounds a little bit heady, huh? A little bit theoretical? It kind of is, but we're going to get really practical today too, okay? So first, we're going to look at Metro-style design. Now, Metro-style design is really all about content before Chrome. That's the underlying principle. But I need to unpack that for you. Content is the reason why your user actually downloaded your app in the first place. Content is the images if it's a photo app, it's the people if it's a social app, or it's the charts and numbers if it's a financial app. All right, that's the content. Chrome is simply everything that's not content. And there tends to be a lot of it, and we're going to see more about that in just a second. There tends to be a lot of Chrome around your application. Now, the reason to show the user just content is to immerse them in that content. It's to make it so that that's the thing that they remember. And the reason to remove the Chrome is to minimize the distractions from them being immersed in that content. Now, our UX team did a really cool survey where they took a number of users that had experience with both traditional desktop-style apps and Metro-style apps, and they asked them to basically draw their experience in both of these platforms. And what you're looking at is what the users drew for the traditional desktop style apps. And as you can see, it's a pretty accurate, literal representation of a desktop app as you and I know it today. We've got Windows, we've got the taskbar. But the thing I want you to note here is that what you're looking at is 100% Chrome. We have here means to open content, means to close content, means to scroll content. But all we have is Chrome. We have information about content. What we don't have here is content. So when those same users were asked to draw their experience with Metro-style applications, this is what they drew. And again, looks pretty literal. It looks a lot like the grid project template that I showed you earlier. The thing to note here is that what you're looking at is entirely content. We have the title of the application, that's important, and we have tiles that represent, again, the images or the people or the conversations, whatever it is that is the core content of your application is what we have represented there. Now, there are a number of reasons why our applications end up with Chrome in them, and they tend to fall in these three categories: layout, interactions, and navigation. So layout means we're trying to separate bits of content from one another on the screen. The interesting thing about this one is if you look at a lot of traditional applications, including the newsreader that I'm going to show you soon, you'll find that the layout is usually trying to separate the content from some Chrome that we're using to browse the content or navigate the content or something like that. So actually, when you go to an immersive application, layout becomes much less necessary. You also get the entire screen to do your layout. You get edge to edge. Interactions are all the ways in which your user interacts with the information on the screen. So it's buttons, controls, things like that. And it's obviously really important to have interactions. Your user needs to interact, but it doesn't need to be extra Chrome. It doesn't need to be visible all the time. We also often have Chrome because of navigation. So we're giving the user sometimes significant portions of our screen real estate just to show them where they might go. Not where they are, but where they might go. And that's what we want to move away from. Now for layout, layout is all about space and typography. Actually, space and typography make up what we call the Metro silhouette. And we're going to talk a lot about the Metro silhouette in just a second. But space is the Metro way of doing layout by putting some breathing room in between bits of content or between the content and the edges of the screen. Breathing room's okay. And actually, since, again, we're recapturing so much space on our screen by going with the Metro design, we have more space to use. And the fact that we get to use that for some breathing room is excellent. We also vary our type size to give the user a little bit of not just information about where things belong on the page, but where they belong hierarchically, structurally. So different type sizes actually give us a lot of information. We also pan along a single axis to set the user's expectations and give them a consistent way of browsing through extra content. And we'll talk more about this Metro silhouette very soon. So what you're seeing here, actually, that other slide got replaced, so I'm going to go to it here. What you're seeing here is a traditional desktop application. And even if you haven't used this specific desktop application, it's going to probably look familiar to you because it looks a lot like many applications that you've used. Now notice that we have a lot of Chrome on this page. In fact, you guys know where the content itself is? That's like 25% of your screen at most that's dedicated to the content. This is the information about what the user is looking at right now, and we can only give them 20 or 25% of the screen for it. The rest of it is information about what they might do, where they might go, or what they might want to know, but not about their content. Okay, so this is what happens when we modify this. We're going to evolve this into a Metro-style application, and I'm going to use this evolution of slides to show you, to illustrate what the change in layout actually does for us. So what we've done here is we've actually just removed the lines, flattened the palette a little bit, and made it look a little bit more like a Metro-style application. We basically upgraded the layout to be a little bit more Metro-style, but it's basically just an old application flattened. It's not Metro yet, so we need to keep going. So there we've taken another dramatic step. This time we've removed all of the navigation, all the information about where a person might go, we don't know, and we've made this a little bit more Metro style. Now, we're still missing some significant Metro design principles, one of which is the fact that our type size is almost entirely the same all the way throughout. Can you guys see how the type, even the header, and the body type is not all that different in size, and it doesn't utilize this typography to convey the kind of information that we want to convey to our users. So watch this next evolution. Watch this slide specifically the typography. You can see now that the fact that we upgraded the header size and upgraded the category size gives us a lot of information. That's visual information that's really important for the user. Now, this is looking a lot better. It's still not a picture-perfect Metro-style application. We've got one more evolutionary step to go. And what we're going to improve upon in this next one is some Chrome that you may or may not notice at first because you're so used to it. Notice the categories at the top. They're not rendering with the content that they describe. They're just rendering in one spot. So this is basically a static navigation bar. Again, more information about where you might want to go, but not information about where you're at. So we're going to upgrade this, and now we've got a really good example of a Metro-style application. We've got our categories actually rendering with our content. So now it doesn't take an intuitive, like a discovery process to try to figure out, like, if I click on this header, is it going to replace what I have or filter what I have or search what I have? How is this going to act? Now we can just see that we have this Core 77 and this Design Milk and all of the items underneath it are intuitively part of that group. We also know that we can just click on that group to go see more information about it, or we can click on that item to go see more information about it. Now this, like I said, is a really good example of a Metro-style application. And I'm going to render an outline, a little overlay here that shows you this Metro-style silhouette. So this consistency of space between the top of your screen and the header, that's part of the silhouette. And the consistency of space between the left and the content, that's part of the Metro silhouette. And you're going to see this characteristic in well-designed Metro applications. Also, the typography, the size of the header there, and as well as the placement, part of the Metro silhouette. Now, the Metro silhouette is described in a lot of detail online, and I actually want to take you there just to introduce you to the fact that this dev.windows.com is not just a good resource for developers, it's good resource for designers as well. So if you go back, if you're a designer, or if you go back to your dev shop and you want to talk to a designer, tell them to go to design.windows.com. It's actually just a subset of dev.windows.com, but it lets them know that we're thinking about them, and it gets them right into the design process. Now, this page is actually a really helpful one, practically speaking. Because you don't have the link, just go to dev.windows.com or design.windows.com and search it for silhouette, and you'll find this. But this is going to outline for us the way that Metro-style applications have a grid, and those grids have some real good definitions for some sizes and some spacing. So we actually have 20-pixel blocks that we call a unit, and we have 5-pixel blocks that we call a subunit. And we lay everything out according to these units and subunits so that we don't have to say things like 175 pixels or something like that. And these increments of 20 and 5 are really well engineered to work with screen scaling so that when your user upgrades his laptop to another one that has higher resolution, the scaling of the screen looks good every time because you've stuck with this unit and subunit principle. So there's a lot of information on here about the spacing of various things. The header is 5 units from the top. All content is 6 units from the bottom. We have spacing between items and their descriptors that are 2 units or 2 subunits. And then we have spacing between lists, and we also have spacing between sections on the page. So a lot of good information there about what spacing to use and when. Okay. So now here are 4 applications, all 4 of which I'm going to put this overlay on so that you can see that all 4 of these applications implement the Metro silhouette, but they have their own personality, and that's what we want. This is not about conformance. This is about consistency and continuity with the Metro principles that are going to set the user's expectations, okay? This is a positive thing for you and as developers. Don't think of this as a constraint. In fact, technically, like as far as the programming is concerned, you don't have those constraints in place. These are design standards. So these applications, like I said, they have their own personality. They look different in a good way. We don't want every view of every application to look like the grid template. And to drive that point home, look at this page. This is what you would see if you were, for instance, playing a track in your music player, And this is maintaining continuity with the Metro design principles. As far as the spacing, it's intentional. It's good. It's compelling. The use of space here is beautiful. This is an application or a view of an application that I want to use. Okay? So just keep that in mind. Feel like you have the power as a developer. Okay? So the second thing that we tend to use Chrome for in our applications is interactions. Command buttons, controls, things like that. Now, here again, the news is good. You get something in the area of interactions, as opposed to having to try to find space on your screen for these buttons that may or may not get clicked. We have these three options. First of which is the best. If you can get the content to speak for itself, to be its own commanding, do that. Even a child can look at a picture on a screen and say, I want to know more about that. They're going to intuit that, right? So you can go ahead and count on it. You don't need an explicit browse button sitting next to that picture. They're going to be able to intuit that. So if you can, let your content command for itself. You also get to leverage the edge. And this is brand new. This is stuff that's coming from off screen. It's like free real estate, right? If your application needs to do something, instead of showing that all the time, leave it on the app bar. When the user wants it, he'll bring it up. It's not only consistent, but it's also available for the user only when he commands. It's like he's requesting it, so he's happy about that, about not having to look at it every time. You also have the right edge. The system charms bar isn't just for system-level things. It allows you to utilize it for your application. You can search your application. You can share items in your application. You can do all kinds of stuff like that by using that edge. So you get the edges. So leverage the edge. Sorry, I went too quick. Also, provide your commands contextually. We have things called flyouts, which are kind of like dialog boxes. And you can use flyouts. And the nice thing about flyouts is that they show up where they're supposed to show up, where the user was just taking action, so where the user is expecting to see them. Also, when you show error messages, make sure that you show the error messages in line, not necessarily where the error occurred, but where the user needs to focus in order to resolve the error. So here's a good example of content that commands for itself. These are probably online shopping categories. And again, as a child, I know, hey, look at that. Holiday shopping, I want to know more about that. I touch it, I go to it. No need for an explicit browse button or anything like that. Let's look at the counter example. Here's a list of products, nondescript products, just generic. Now, you might look at that and say, okay, there's buttons on each of those. For each of those, I could like them, or I could email them, or I could download them. So that's okay. You can figure out how that works, but there's a couple problems with it. First of all, it's visual noise. This Chrome is distracting from what this screen is actually showing, a list of products. And if you show this as just a list of products, it's all the more beautiful because it's just a list of products, okay? These images can be compelling, and we want them to speak for themselves. So notice I changed it to conform to the design principle that I can select two of these products, and then I can choose on my app bar from these contextual commands. These commands, I think it was mentioned before, show up on the left side of the screen because they pertain to something that the user selected. In a second, I'll show you an example of some global commands. So here, we're back to our newsreader application, and we're going to leverage the edge, okay? There's something in this newsreader application that we want to do, and we don't have a button for it. We want to refresh it, or we want to add a feed to our newsreader. So boom, we bring up the application bar. These buttons are rendered on the right side because they're global. They don't refer to just a specific news item. They're global to the application. So we show them on the right. Okay? You've leveraged the edge. Now I want to share a news article, or I want to search for news articles. Boom, I swipe from the right. I've got my charms, and I can do that. This is stuff that I didn't have to put on the screen and distract the user with, because I could just put it there. These are flyouts. Flyouts are great for transient contextual data, because first of all, they're really easy to dismiss. We don't demand that the user respond with an acknowledgement or a dismissal of this dialog box before we let them go on. These are, in fact, what we call, in the Metro design language, a light dismiss. Meaning that if the user just clicks outside of the screen or touches outside of the screen, it goes away. So we're not demanding an answer. Subsequently, there's not usually a cancel button in them. Dialog boxes usually have cancel buttons, but flyouts don't usually need cancel buttons because they're light dismiss. And again, the nice thing about them is that they show up where the user would expect. He just clicked add. We want to ask him what category. We show a flyout right there next to the category. And then error messages. We want error messages to, we don't want to reserve space on the screen for error messages. I'm thinking about like, you know, a lot of traditional desktop applications that have a status bar. This is like reserved space. Like I'm going to take up some of your real estate just in case I need to show something in there for you to look at. We're not doing that. We're bringing up this error message information only if an error occurs, and we're going to do it where the user needs to focus to fix the problem. Okay, we're on to the third reason why we have Chrome show up in our applications, and that's navigation. The principle, again, with MetroStyle applications is that we tell the user all about where they are. We don't need to tell them all about where they need to go because the content is going to speak for itself. They're going to be able to get there by clicking on that. Okay, the navigation structure is going to take us there. I'm going to show you these two navigation patterns, hierarchical and flat. And then finally, we have semantic zoom. And you've seen semantic zoom and how it allows the user to pinch, just like he was doing an optical zoom in say, maps or something. But instead of just optically zooming, it actually changes the scope of the list that he's looking at and semantically gives him a broader view of that information. So, it's another means of navigating well. Here's that hierarchical pattern. So I talked about this in the project templates. This is what you get out of the box with the grid project template. And really, it has these three tiers that you've seen, the hub, the sections, and the details. Now, if your application, if you're saying, you know what, this doesn't work for me, my data is so complex, I'm going to need a six-tier navigation model. You need to rethink your data and figure out how it fits in the three-tier navigation model. Why? Because this is what users are going to come to expect, and this is going to change your data in a good way. So for instance, on the hub, only the data that you want to bubble up is going to bubble up and show up on the hub. And if you have too much information on the hub, if you have too much information on your screen, we're telling you the users are going to be lost. The users are going to turn away. If they have to come to your application and figure out how your application works that's different from all these other applications that they're used to, you're going to turn your users away. A good example of this is the store. So if you want a refresher on what a good example of a hierarchical model is, go to the store. You've got hub. You've got your sections. Those are the categories or topics, and then you've got your details page, which is all about a specific application. Now, the flat pattern is quite different. The flat pattern basically says, you know what, I don't have an application that really needs navigation of complex content in any way. It's just flat. And the best example here is Internet Explorer. You've got Internet Explorer, the navigation is really inherent to the web the sites that you're going to. And so all you really want to do for Internet Explorer is give the user the option of opening, closing, and managing multiple peer sections. Think of them as tabs. That's exactly what they are in classic Internet Explorers, tabs. Okay? So that's a flat navigation model. So we finally made it onto the second of the eight traits of a well-designed Metro application. But don't be worried, because that one was disproportionately large. The rest of these are a little bit quicker. Next, we're going to look at how Metro-style applications are fast and fluid. Now, honestly, the fast and fluid component, that feeling that you get when you're browsing a Windows 8 machine, a lot of that is done. You don't have to worry about it. But there's some stuff that you should be clued into as a developer. Two things that are huge in MetroStyle applications, obviously, are animation and touch. Now, with animation, you get, if you use the controls that are built in, you get animation out of the box. Your lists are going to animate like a list should. Your control box, checkboxes are going to animate like a checkbox should, whatever. But you also have the animation libraries in your respective languages that you get to take control by way of. So that if you're doing something that you can't use a standard control for, you can still jump in and use a component of the animation library. And it's going to animate the way that you expect. Animation should always, by the way, be complementary. We don't want to just get fancy with it to show off that we can move things around. Which reminds me of when we started making word processor applications, and everybody discovered like multiple fonts. And so every publication that you saw from then on was just fonts, 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 like seven fonts in one document. We want to stay away from that. We also want to make sure that we give instant visual feedback. Sometimes if you just use a button, then you're going to get this for free. But if you create your own something, like a button, you want to make sure that the state of that button changes when the user touches the screen, so it feels like they touched something. And you don't want to commit it until they let their finger up, so that they have a chance to slide their finger off and change their mind. Which leads me to my next point, that you want your actions to be reversible. Because you want your user to feel safe, like he can use your application, change something, and then if he goofs up, he can always just change it right back. Okay? So reversibility is good. Also, if you're ever in control of content moving, again, most of it's the drag and drop and stuff, it's all built in, you've got that packaged. But if you're ever in control of moving things around on the screen with the finger, make sure that the content follows the finger linearly so that the user feels like they're in control of it. You should prescribe to the Windows 8 gestures. These are the defined gestures for Windows 8, and you should not override this functionality with some other gesture that's going to leave the user wondering, what do I need to do in order to affect the change I want to affect? If the action exists and the gesture exists, use the existing gesture to set the user's expectation. Next, we want to make sure that we snap and scale beautifully. We have applications now that are going to appear on anything from a tiny device, tiny tablet, all the way up to a great big screen TV that's showing up on a Media Center PC. So you need to think about what screen your application is going to be showing up on. Okay? And there's a lot of them. Now, really, your application content is going to be probably of one of two types. Either it's adaptive, meaning that you want it to adapt to the size of the screen, or it's fixed, meaning that it basically just needs to scale up. So for adaptive, think about like a newsreader. You want it to reorient the articles and take advantage of more room. But for a fixed layout, think about a checkers board. You don't really want to reorient a checkers board or change the proportions in any way. It's a checkers board. So you're really just going to scale it to the size of the screen. You may, however, get fancy and decide, if my proportion changes and I've got enough margin space for around my checkers board, then maybe all of a sudden I'll show my leaderboard because I've got the space for it. Now, I want to show you what happens to your content as your screen gets bigger if you use, for instance, the built-in list views and such. This is on a tablet with a smaller screen. This is a 1024 by 768. But watch as we grow in size here. What happens to our content? We're revealing more content each time. So this is what happens when nothing changes except for the screen size. We're going to look in a second at what happens when nothing changes except for the pixel density or resolution. So if the screen size changes, you can do three things. Show more content, make the content bigger, or at least manage the white space. Don't make it look like you didn't mean to do that. Like, oops, I didn't know you were going to be running this on your Media Center PC, and now I've got fields of white that are lonely and sad. So if you are doing certain kinds of applications like the newsreader that I just showed, you probably want to reorient your content and show more. If you're doing something like a weather application, there's a good chance that you just want to show your same information bigger. Maybe show a little bit more, but now maybe we're imagining that the person's watching it on a big screen TV, and we want to show their weather really big, so we just kind of increase their experience. Those are your options. So here's as you're actually laying this out and thinking about the elements on the page, a page like this is the second tier in the grid application. We want, for instance, the header to stay right where it's at. And then we want this information about the group that's below it to stay pinned to that left side of the screen. And then the right side is the part that we want to modify. So let's in our minds divide this up and say, I'm gonna tack my header and my description where they're at, but then I'm gonna give this content area some room to grow to the sides. So that's the part that's gonna expand. And the built-in controls that are in XAML and then the controls that we've given you in JavaScript applications are really great at this. They can give you a lot of power in laying your stuff out exactly the way you want it. Okay, so I talked about what we do as developers to react whenever the screen size changes. But whenever the resolution changes, this becomes an interesting problem on a tablet. What you're looking at now is fictional. This is not the way it works, okay? We have an 11.6-inch device with different resolutions. Now, normally, when you go change the resolution on your desktop, what happens to the size of the icons on your desktop? They get smaller, exactly. They get smaller because the size of the pixels on your screen got smaller, and so now all of a sudden a 20-pixel wide icon is smaller. It takes up 20 pixels or actually narrower. Well, if this happened on the tablet, we'd run into a significant problem. That is, the inherent touchability of the controls on the page is going to go away as, for instance, the size of the button decreases down below the size of a basketball player's finger. He's not going to be able to use the application anymore because it's gotten smaller. And what happens when we just keep cranking the resolution up? The problem's going to be exaggerated. So what we do instead, Windows 8 scales your application automatically. You don't have to do that. You don't have to do your own scaling. That happens out of the box, but you do need to react to it in some ways. Okay? So what do you as the developer need to do? Actually, first of all, what is it that a person gets when they buy a device with a better resolution if they don't get more content on the screen? They get higher resolution content. So this might be a little bit difficult to read, but you can see that, I think you can see that in the circle on the right, you get higher quality content whenever the user's resolution is higher, not necessarily more content. So how do we as developers need to react to this or plan for this? Well, first of all, we need to use vector-based imagery anytime we can because of its inherent scalability. So that's always a good idea. But when we're using bitmaps, which we're inevitably going to do, we want to, first of all, ensure that they're rendered crisp. We want to specify their size explicitly so Windows knows what size you want that to be. And finally, we get to take advantage of this bitmap resource loading. What this is a naming convention that we go with that allows you as the developer to specify, this is my image that I want to use under normal pixel density, 100%, that 100 stands for 100%. This is the image I want to use whenever the pixel density is at 140%, and then here at 180%. And Windows chooses these automatically, and it grabs that image, and it uses the correct image, and renders that for you on the screen. Okay? That's nice. It's work done for you. Okay, now as far as the states that your application can appear in Windows, it can appear in full, it's taken up the whole thing, it can appear in fill, or it can appear in snapped. Then the user can rotate their device and it can appear in portrait. Okay, and there's no snapping in portrait, it takes up the full screen. So these are the different view states that your application might show up in. Now, keep in mind, these are not optional. Okay, all applications are snappable. Your application will be snappable. It just might look really bad in the snap state, so you're going to have to plan for that. It might not make it through. There's a good chance it won't make it through the store if it just looks awful. Now, your application may or may not need to do very much in the snap state. Some don't need to do too much. For instance, the Maps application. I'm going to just see a smaller view of my map, but I'm still going to be able to browse it the same as I did before. Okay? Other applications need to significantly change their layout for the snapped view. Now, you always want to make sure that you strive for feature parity. That means try to do as much in the snapped view as you can to make it work the same as the other views. You won't be able to get everything in because you're working with 320 pixels. But do as much as you can for feature parity. Don't pare it down too much. Keep the user in control. And also, don't forget, somebody can snap another application next to yours and put yours into the fill state, and you need to respond to that too. Oftentimes, the fill state can act just like the full state. So when your application is snapped, you still have a command bar. It's going to show up underneath your application if you swipe up from the bottom of the screen under the snapped app. Whereas if you swipe up underneath the other app, it's going to appear underneath there. But under the snapped app, you actually get icons that are rendered, your command bar buttons, rather, that are rendered without their text label, because there's just not the room. And you can actually fit 5 icons down there. If you do more, they'll start wrapping on second row, and it's not going to look good, okay? So think about what app commands show up whenever you're in the app state, and remember that you don't get that text description for them, so the user's going to have to decipher it based on the image that they see. Okay, we also need to use the right contracts. The contracts are really powerful in making your application work well with other applications and actually giving the user a good end-to-end usage scenario. They're not just going to use your application, get out, use a different application, get out. Users are interested in getting something done, and so they use multiple apps. They use this whole scenario. Now, you've seen the searching and the sharing, and you're going to see more of those in a little bit. But one that I think is extremely exciting that we haven't seen much of yet is the file picker functionality. Now, of course, any app can consume file picker functionality, but that works a lot like it did in traditional desktop applications where it opens the file open command dialog and whatever appears there is available for your application, right? So technically speaking, consuming a file picker is kind of similar. But the cool thing is that if you make an application and you implement the file sharing or the file picking contract such that you're the source or you're the server of those files, then any application that's on the user's machine that needs to pick a file is going to be able to pick not only from the system, but from your application as well. So think about, I'm in an application and I want a picture, and so I say, I'm going to go choose a picture. And it opens my file picker and it allows me to choose a picture from the system, or from my SkyDrive, or from Facebook. Well, what about when the next, like, Picture Wizard 2014 comes out? It's going to implement the file picture wizard, and all of a sudden, your application is going to be able to pick files from Picture Wizard 2014, even though you've never even heard of the program yet. So that's cool. That's the power of contracts, is that you don't have to know anything about the other application to all of a sudden have this functionality. Have you guys seen on websites how we have share with Twitter, share with Facebook, share with this, share with that? Oh, a new one's here. Now I got to go redesign my website and add this one. No more of that. All you have to know is about the sharing contract or about the file picker contract, and all of a sudden you get all those for free. Application settings are another contract that you should definitely implement. You want to make sure that you invest in a great tile. This is another of the 8 traits of a well-designed Metro-style application. The tile is the front door to your application. You're not just informing your user, you're inviting them into your application so that they'll use it, so that they'll love it, so that they'll pay for it, right? So the tile is really important. You want your tiles to be like constantly active, pictures changing, you know, so that you're getting that user to the that information to the user and they're feeling connected and alive through the tile. And so that they're feeling like clicking on your application because, hey, I've got 2 more whatever. I want to go in there and I want to see them. Besides the primary tile, you also have the ability to do secondary tiles. So it's like a side door. So let's say, for instance, you have a weather application and you want to give people the ability to not only link to your weather application and enter it the normal way, but you also want to give them the ability to pin a secondary tile that is weather in a different location. Now all of a sudden you have 2 doors on their start menu to invite them into your application, to use it, to love it, to pay for it. You also want to make sure that you keep the user feeling like he's connected and alive. This basically means the right information comes to the user, is updated, animated on the screen, and he feels like this is an organic system that he's interacting with. You want the user to feel like he's interacting with his information. That's really important. The way that we do this primarily is through notifications. Notifications use the same template behind the scenes for you as developers as do the tiles. So you get a lot of power over what you actually pack into those. And you want to make sure that you bring the user information that he elects, but not information that's going to annoy him, because you want him to feel like he's the one that's in control and he's the one that's choosing what he sees. Make sure that you roam to the cloud. You want to roam not just your user's preferences, but also their tasks. I'll give you some examples. First of all, their preferences. If I pick up a slate and I say, I like the Denver Broncos, and then I go to another device, what are the chances I still like the Denver Broncos? Pretty good, right? It's about me. It's not about this device. And we want the user to feel like they're interacting with information, not interacting with that device. Okay, so roam their preferences to the cloud. Also, you want to roam their tasks to the cloud. Because if I'm on the bus on my way to work and I'm emailing somebody and then I get interrupted is what happens on the bus, and so I turn off my device real quick and then I show up at work and I turn on my PC, there's no reason we can't let the user continue writing that email. No reason. So roam that information to the cloud and take advantage of that. That's a well-designed Metro-style application. Finally, we want to embrace the Metro-style design principles. And this is what they are. First, show pride in your craftsmanship. This means sweat the details because every pixel matters. The color palette matters. The type matters. It matters what you choose. It matters how your app is designed. Don't make an ugly app. Make an app that delights users. These days, the bar is high. People want beautiful applications. So show that pride. Do more with less. This means that we break away from this modern trajectory of packing so much stuff onto the surface of our application that we lose the essence of the content that we intend to give the user. So don't pack it all on there. Think about what it is that you're showing your user, what the content is, in fact, what the specific content is for that one view, for that one page, and give them that. We want to make sure that we remain authentically digital. That means that we utilize modern digital systems and so that we can act efficiently and intelligently with the user's information. So this includes bringing them notifications and roaming to the cloud and getting information to them. That's being authentically digital. And finally, we want to win as one. That means that we implement the share contracts, we do a good job of sharing with other applications so that we give these users this full good experience on Windows 8 platform from application to application for their full usage scenario, not just in this one application. Okay, how's everybody feeling? It feels like we're at school, right? A lot of head information. We're going to get a little bit more practical here. We're actually going to design an application from the ground up. Now, this application is called Food with Friends, and it's an application that we intend to use so that I can elect some restaurants that I like, my friends can elect restaurants that they like, and then we can decide based on which ones we have in common where we want to eat tonight. So when you're designing an application, do these five things. First, create a best at statement. What is this application going to be best at? We're going to look at these in detail. Choose the right scenarios, pick your navigation pattern, then lay out your content, and then create your app bar and all the commanding for your application. So first, your best at statement. This app is the best in its category at what? Now, if you've already started down the road of making an application, great for you. If you haven't done a best at statement, make sure you round back and write one for your application. It'll give you focus, and you'll be able to see the things that you're doing that don't support the best at. Make it specific, make it one sentence, and make sure that it's differentiating. So for our application, Food with Friends, the best app in its category at helping users and their friends find a restaurant to eat at tonight. Very specific. Who? Me and my friends. What? Find a restaurant when? Tonight. Part two, choose the right scenarios. You're not going to have any trouble coming up with all the scenarios that you want for your app. You probably have a million ideas of all the things that it can do. But make sure that you only pick the ones that support your best at statement. Great design begins with saying no to all the things that don't support that best at statement. So here's a bunch of scenarios that we might choose from. But I'm going to eliminate the ones that are just features. They're things that are just going to happen as the result of a button click or something. They're not actual scenarios. And then I'm going to remove the scenarios that don't tie into my best at statement. And I'm going to end up with a relatively small list of scenarios. These are the few things that my app is going to do and do well. So I have my best at statement, and I have my three scenarios. Find restaurants that my friends want to eat at. Find restaurants that I want to eat at. And finally, make dinner plans for tonight with my friends. Pick a navigation pattern. This one's obviously going to be the hierarchical pattern because it's got a lot of content. And we need that vertical. We need that component. We need to be able to browse through the information. Finally, we need to, not finally, part four, we need to lay out our content. And in this case, we're going to be, since we're choosing the hierarchical pattern, we're going to lay out our hub. Now, keep in mind that the app is the hub. The hub is the app. When a user sees your hub, they should have a broad view of your entire application from end to end. They don't see all the details necessarily, but they see a broad view of everything that your application has to offer. The sections at the second level, those are tailored for their content. And you want to make sure that you're constantly bubbling up information to the hub so that when I come, for instance, in Food with Friends to the restaurant section in my hub, I should see, hey, there's a new restaurant that just showed up on the scene. I might want to try that one. So let's walk through this application layout. Starting with the basic grid application. The first thing that we're going to do looks small, but it actually represents a lot of work. We picked a title, and we picked our sections. These sections mirror the scenarios that you chose for your application. So this is food with friends, and we have a section for tonight, a section for our friends' wish lists, and then we have a section for my wish list, and a section for all restaurants. All right? Those sections mirror the scenarios that your application is going to be good at. Now we're going to start designing this. Now first, we lay out the tonight section, and we decide that we're going to lay this out. This is a little bit of a design decision. We're going to lay this out a little bit like a chat, because this is real active, real dynamic, real immediate. And this is me and my friends deciding where we're going to eat tonight. So even though it's not strictly a chat, it's very similar. It's going to be like a chat plus, like extra functionality in there. And so we decide to lay that out like that. Now our second section, friends wish lists, we lay that out in a horizontal list of vertical panels. And you can already see that these different sections don't look like the grid application at all. Maybe some of them are reminiscent, but these have their own character, their own personality. And actually, we're going to choose some colors such that we give it a little bit more personality even. And we add a picture in the background of some pasta that makes it feel like a food application. So we've gotten real customized here. We've gotten an application that feels good. It feels right. It feels like a food application. Now, how does that fit into the navigation structure? That was the hub. We just did the hub. That's the top. Now we need to take each of those sections and bring those down to the next level. Now, this is not a panoramic like the hub where you browse all the different sections. This is one at a time. You go to one or the other of these sections. Because remember, we need the space to show an exhaustive list of all of the items that might show up in that section. And finally, we design the detail level. There's only two kinds of things, two entities that we need to raise in this application. People and restaurants. Okay? So those are the only two detail pages that we need. Now let's look at our navigation. The user might click on these headers from the hub and browse to this individual section that he elects to see. Then he might click on an item in that section and be taken to the details page. Or from the hub, if by chance the restaurant that he's interested in is showing up, it happens to be in that list, he can choose it directly from there, bypass the second tier, and go all the way down to the bottom level, to the details. He can also, what you just saw rendered over here on the left is a header menu. I'll zoom in on that. This header menu actually is kind of a way of jumping out of this linear traversal and jumping into another section directly from the header. So this is an expectation we can set for the user that they can, whenever they see a header with the chevron next to it, they can boom, jump, immediately go to a different section. And there we go. So we've laid out our application. And the last thing that we need to do is we need to create our app bars. So this is the interactions, the commanding. This is the buttons that we need to work on. So we've got lots of features, huge list of features, all kinds of things that our app needs to be able to do, right? This is not, again, a difficult list to come up with. It's usually much more difficult paring down than it is coming up with that list. But again, great design begins with saying no. So, we start pairing. We start off with the huge list, but then we remove all the features that don't align with the scenarios that we ended up choosing. Nix those ones. Then, we remove the features that we can leverage charms in order to do. And look how many of them there are. Search for a restaurant? Don't need to put that in our application. We've got a charm for that. Create an account? Don't need to put that in our application. We've got a charm for that. That would go in the settings section. Okay, so those can just go away, boom, because we've got the charms. Remove features that are laid out as a part of the content. This is that great way of commanding I told you about. Let the content speak for itself. So for instance, to read a review, we don't need a button for that. We just touch the review. Okay, and we see the review because we're on the restaurant and we have that context. Finally, we don't need cut, copy, paste because that's given to us in a context menu. So here we are. This is the complete list of features that remain. These have all got to get put in our application somewhere. So we sort them by the scenario that they have to do with. If it has to do with all the restaurants, that section, or your friend's wish lists, or whatever. And we make sure that we consider the fact that this great user experience that we want means a flow through your application, a flow that involves predictability and intuition. We want the user to know where to go next because it makes sense, because it's intuitive. That's important. And to do this, think about the context that you're in. Are you on a page that is dedicated to a person, a friend? That's your context, that person. Or are you on a page that's dedicated to a restaurant? That's your context. So let's start on the hub. And there are two features that we need to drop into here. New plan and vote on a suggestion, which is only going to show up when we have a selection. So new plan is global. We want that to show up right here, new plan. If a person brings up the app bar, they get that new plan object command button on the right, and they can choose that directly. Now, veto a selection, it only shows up whenever they actually highlight at least one of the items on the page. And when they've highlighted one of those plans that's in the tonight section, they can vote. I'm in, I'm out, or eh, I'm not sure. I'm semi on that one. I'm undecided. Let's move on to the All Restaurants section. In the All Restaurants section, we still want to be able to do new plan, so we leave that in the global section, but we also want to be able to switch views from the list view to the map view and back to the list view. We also want to be able to filter and sort. So here we've got sort by rating, convenience, category, and filter by all these things. Notice the problem with this? There's too many, right? So we take our sorts and our filters and we stack them up. And we use dialogues, we use flyouts to give them the details on those. Now the only buttons that we have, the only command buttons are the sort and the filter, and all the details of sorting and filtering show up in those flyouts. That's good practice. Finally, we have suggestion that needs to appear when they have something highlighted. We also have, a wish list. And notice the wish list button here is empty. When we click, it's going to act like a toggle button. When we click on it, it's been added to the wish list. If we want to remove it, we simply click again. Okay, finally, we're on the restaurant detail page. From the restaurant detail page, we need to be able to suggest. This is global because we have our context, right? We're on a restaurant. I don't need to ask you which restaurant you want to suggest. It's this one. I can also add this to my wish list or remove it from my wish list. I can also review. This is a global command. I can also vote in, veto, or meh. So there you have it. That is the fully designed application, ready, theoretically, to pack up and hand over to our developer friends to develop it, to implement the graphics, to implement the code, to make it work. Okay? I hope that between the theory that we saw and the practice that we saw, you guys are impacted by the fact that we have a significant impetus on us to design our applications well according to the Metro design language. Not just jump right into development, but to design them well to make applications that ultimately result in good user experience. Okay? So again, I'm Jeremy Foster. You can find me online at Code Foster. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. So how's everybody doing? So I think we're going to do a little bit of exercise while Matt Harrington comes out and gets set up to talk to us about UI and contracts. So everybody stand up. You've got to stand up. Got to get our energy back up again. Everybody stand up. Especially the guys who are up at the very top, up there at the top where I was sitting, where they were sleeping. Everybody wave to them up there. How you doing? Oh, yeah, they're awake now. Good. Okay, hands up. A little bit of a stretch. Okay, look at your neighbor. Shake their hand. Introduce yourself. Okay, it's all about networking coming to these events, too. Okay, so most of you are developers, right? So this is probably the most important part of this exercise. Okay, so anybody who is a designer by trade, raise your hand. Okay, these are the people you want to make friends with because they're the ones who are really going to make your apps look pretty. Okay? How we doing? Matt needs one more minute.
10 seconds.
10 seconds. Okay, anybody need any questions? Oh, I was told. Okay, so I got feedback. So for those of you that are on the live stream, I don't want you to disconnect. Because I got feedback that I told everybody to disconnect from the live stream. Okay, so I want you to stay on. It's just the people in here that should not necessarily be on the live stream. It's funny, the things you say, you kind of never know the unintended consequence, right? Okay, everybody's got some good energy? Everybody's ready, back? Because we're going to keep getting deeper as the day goes on. Deeper and deeper every time. Okay, come on, let's hear it one more time. Come on, put it out there. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Harrington.
Hey, everyone.
Great. My name is Matt Harrington. This section is going to be mildly interactive if you want it to be. You don't have to play along if you don't want to. You're not going to miss anything out, miss out on anything. But if you want to play along, take a look at the bit.ly URL on this title slide here. I'm going to mention that URL about 5 more times throughout the session, so don't feel like you need to catch it right now if you miss it. You can also find it by just searching online for my name on your little card. It's Matt Harrington, Matt Harrington Microsoft, or Matt Harrington MSDN. We'll go to my blog. So this bit.ly, bit.ly/metrointeractions, goes to my blog, and just about an hour or two ago, I put a post up there that covers the 5 code samples that I'm going to be talking about. So if you're feeling like you want to participate here and follow along with what I'm doing, don't feel obligated. But if you want to, go to this URL, and you'll be able to see the 5 code samples. They're on the Windows Dev Center, dev.windows.com. You can download them, the source code, and then build them in Visual Studio and play along with them as I demo them here too. But again, I'm going to mention this URL like 5 more times throughout the session. If you missed it just now, don't worry about it. Ask your neighbor, or again, just search for Matt Harrington Microsoft on the online, and you'll find it. So again, Matt Harrington, I'm a developer evangelist from San Francisco. I used to live down here, though, so I really feel good coming back when I landed in LAX. There's just something in the air, and not smog, but something in the air that just makes me feel like I was at home. And I've lived up there for a while, but I definitely miss the Mexican food down here, and I'm still a Dodgers fan. So let's move on. Metro interactions, what does that mean? So I'm going to talk about the hallmark of Windows 8 Metro-style applications, the 5 hallmarks of Metro-style applications. So I'm going to talk about the Metro-style user interface controls. I'll talk about the search and share contracts, which you've been hearing about all day, which users invoke through the search and share charms. I'll talk about toast notifications and live tile updates. So you'll leave with examples of how to create great Windows 8 experiences in your own applications. So let's jump right in and talk about the Metro-style user interface controls. So if you take a look at this screen here, you'll see what we call the everyday widgets. So the user interface controls that you'll probably be using in all of the applications that you build. And starting in the upper left, there's a button. Just, you know, scrolling through the first column there, there's checkbox, combo box, date picker. Earlier, someone asked me at the device bar if Windows 8 had a date picker control. There's proof that it does. I tried convincing them that it does, and there's the proof right there. In the middle column, you'll see a list box and a couple progress progress options. And on the right, in the upper right corner, you'll see a ratings control. In the lower right corner, you'll see a toggle switch, which I'll actually show you how to code up. It's really dead simple. So you'll notice that right out of the box, you get the Metro-style look and feel with these controls if you use the everyday controls. So they use the font that's very common in Windows 8 and Windows Phone, for that matter. It's called Sego. And they're also optimized for touch. Of course, they support keyboard and mouse. You can run Windows 8 on your desktop or your laptop machine that doesn't have touch just fine. But if you had touch, these controls are optimized for touch. And by that, I mean the padding and margin around all of these controls is big enough so that your finger can actually touch these things and you don't have to tap on something small like you would with a mouse. So that's what I mean by they're optimized for touch. And then they also have the Metro-style animations, which really make these user interface controls come to life. So just take a look at the button in the upper left corner, and you can see that's the same button control, it's the same button element, but styled in 3 different ways. So the one on the left is a back button, in the middle there's a submit button, and on the right there's an OK button. Right out of the box, that's what you get. Now here are the exact same controls, but styled completely differently. So I just, in the last slide, talked about the button in the upper left. That's that same button in the upper left, but the buttons look very different. So I'll go back to this slide. These are the styles that you get out of the box. You can make your own custom styles. So on the left, underneath button there, you can see a play button. It's a metallic-looking play button. In the middle there, there's a button that says schedule, and on the right, there's a button that says login. So the idea here is don't feel constrained to the look and feel of these controls that you get right out of the box. Don't feel like you need to make your own controls if you can find something that we do that's almost what you want but differs in style, because you can make up your own styles. So if you're a JavaScript and HTML5 person, you just style these controls with CSS3 like you would be doing on the web. Or if you're a XAML person, you would just style them with XAML styles. Really, really simple. And so there's some pretty clever uses of styles here. Below that, that's a checkbox, and that is a red heart and a black heart for, you know, like and dislike, for example. The date picker has the background color changed. The progress bars also have background images added. In the upper right corner, there's a ratings control, and it's been changed from stars on the previous slide to hot chili peppers here, maybe indicating spiciness or something like that. The slider control is completely different here, maybe for some sort of audio application. And in the lower right is our friend the toggle switch, which I'll be showing you how to code up on the next screen here. The point here is that you're not limited by the styles that you get out of the box. So as you've been hearing throughout the day, there are parallel paths for development through Windows 8. You can go down the XAML path if you're a Silverlight or WPF developer. This is going to be very, very familiar to you. It's just XAML. Or if you come from the web world, you can use what you know already with JavaScript and HTML5. The same things are available in both worlds. So on the right side of the screen, you'll see this toggle switch that I've been mentioning. Very simple toggle switch that says Wi-Fi networking on or off when you click it. On the left side of the screen is the code that you'll actually write to write that toggle. You'll see 4 lines of XAML there, or actually we could compress it to 3 lines if we had the closing brace put on the third line. So we simply create a toggle switch control, and then there are 2 properties assigned to this control. Header equals a string, that's just Wi-Fi networking in this case, and then we assign a unique ID, or use XName, and give this control a unique ID, a unique name of myToggle. On the last line in the screen, you'll see a line from the C# code behind file. So if you're a XAML developer, this is going to be really, really familiar to you. You have one file that has your XAML in it, the markup for your user interface, and you have another file which is the code behind in C# or VB.NET or something like this. Again, in this last line from the code behind file, we simply pay attention to the toggled event on the myToggle UI, the myToggle control. And we hook up an event handler to this. Whenever the toggled event fires, an event handler called toggle Wi-Fi will be run. And I don't define that function here. So this is very simple. If you're a XAML person, this will look very, very familiar. Now here's the exact same thing for HTML people. So on the right side of the screen, you'll see the toggle control. Looks just the same as it did on the previous slide. On the left side of the screen, you'll see 4 lines of HTML, which actually creates that control. You'll see that it's a div. It's actually an opening div and a closing div and nothing in between it. So in the first line, you'll see an attribute on the div called data-win-control. And on the second line, you'll see a similar attribute, which is data-win-options. So it turns out in HTML5, you can create any attribute on an HTML element that begins with data-. And at Microsoft, we use data-win for Windows 8 Metro-style applications. So in the first line, we say data win control equals winjs.ui.toggle. So that's saying that what I'm creating here is a toggle control. It's what tells the system, hey, create a toggle control here. And in the second line, data win options, we just pass in a JavaScript object. If you're a JavaScript developer, that's going to look very, very familiar. You just pass in a JavaScript object, which sets the title to Wi-Fi networking. Then on the third line, we have ID equals my toggle, and that's just also from HTML development. You're just assigning an ID, like an HTML ID attribute, to be my toggle. And then we have the closing div tag, and nothing in between there, so no text or anything like this. In the last line of this file, you'll see the code behind. This is in JavaScript. And if you're a web developer, this will also look very, very familiar. In the first half of that line, we call winjs.ui.getControlMyToggle. That just gets a handle to the myToggle control, the div that I've described, that I've defined in the first 4 lines of this file. And then we call addEventListener on that control. We pay attention to the change event, and when the change event fires, we call this callback function here called toggle Wi-Fi, which I don't define on this slide. It's going to be another function that would actually react to the toggle control being clicked. So addEventListener should look really, really familiar to JavaScript developers out there. So again, if you're a XAML person, what I showed in the previous slide will look very, very easy and very, very familiar. And if you're an HTML5 and JavaScript person, this should look really simple too. So this is as simple as it gets for doing Windows 8 applications. So the format of this talk is going to be a couple of PowerPoint slides kind of setting up something, and then I'm going to drop into Visual Studio and play around with some code samples that are on this bit.ly link, which goes to my blog, which in turn goes to the Windows Dev Center, where you can download these exact samples that I'm going to be running here. There are, I believe, 200 or 300 megabytes of code samples on the Windows Dev Center, dev.windows.com. You really should download the entire pack. Not here today on our Wi-Fi because it would be a lot for everyone in the room to do that. But when you get home, I would download that entire sample pack. Again, it's 200 or 300 megabytes, and just go through them and just see some things that you like. Kick the tires on this kind of stuff. Look at the source code and then just cut and paste that source code into your own applications. We won't mind, really. So bit.ly/metrointeractions. So here is here's the Metro Interaction sample from the Windows Dev Center. So on the upper left here, you'll see various scenarios, 1 through 14, it looks like. And the idea here is to just, like I said a second ago, kick the tires on these things. So in this scenario here, there are all sorts of range bars. So these are touch-optimized, but they also work with a mouse. So they're touch-optimized, meaning that they have a sort of target area that's large enough for your finger to hit and then drag. And then the number above it, in this case 54, if you were to slide this back and forth, it's not going to be blocked by your finger. So we just think about how to make touch really, really easy with these controls. The range control, the range slider can also be put vertically. You can customize the step here. You don't have to rely on the sort of an infinite step. It can be continuous if you like. Change the background color. You can also put a background image, like in this last control here. And in this last control, we have a background image which just styles this to be some sort of ramped gradient. So the idea is that just you can customize these controls as you like. Here's the range control stylized even more to be a seek bar in a video, playing a video. Again, they're optimized for touch. And I believe the device I'm using right now is not a 10-point multi-touch system. But if I had a 10-point laptop here and I had 10 fingers, I could grab all 10 of these graphic equalizer sliders here and move them up and down. There are various progress bars. You can see them here, all sorts of animations. There's a file download example. Here's our old friend, the button. Submit buttons, you can style the background colors and things like this. You can change the image to look like a back button instead of a submit button. Checkboxes have some interesting stuff. You can turn this into a like and dislike or neutral if you like. So again, broken heart. So again, it would be great if you downloaded this later on and just kick the tires with it. Now earlier you heard about hitting Alt F4 to just quit out of these applications. So if you've been using Visual Studio for years like I have, you're very used to hitting F5, running your application, and then hitting the Xbox to close your application, and it dumps back to Visual Studio and closes the debugger. Well, since we emphasize full screen applications in Windows 8 here, it's a little bit tricky because there's no X to dismiss it. So you can hit Alt F4. You can also hit Windows key D and it goes back to the desktop. What I find myself doing all the time, and I just want to pass off this tip to you, it's not state secret or anything like that. You just go to the upper left corner here and then you click and that brings you back to the previously running application and then I just hit stop. So I find that that's easiest. Otherwise, there might be multiple steps to sort of drop back to the desktop, then find Visual Studio, then quit the debugger, and then find the source code that you're looking at. So again, you can download this application and take a look at the source code yourself. Now, earlier, you learned about the DOM Explorer if you are a JavaScript and HTML5 developer. So while this app was running, you could use the DOM Explorer feature in Visual Studio to move your mouse over and select an element, and then it would highlight that code in Visual Studio here, and you could see exactly how to code it up yourself. So take a look at the default.html and all the JavaScript for the code behind on this thing, on this example, and cut and paste it to your heart's delight. Okay, those were everyday widgets, the Metro-style UI controls. So moving on to point 2 now, we're going to talk about the search contract. So here's what happens when a user invokes the search contract through the search charm. And again, the way that you would get to this would be swiping in with your thumb from the right on a touch device, or you could hold down the Windows key and hit C to invoke the charms, for example, or you could activate it with the mouse also. So in step 1 here, the search box is scoped to the main app on screen. And in this example, it's a screenshot from the Bing app, which would be running in the where all of the text for the PowerPoint is now. Just pretend there's a Bing app running there. And if the user invoked the search charm, the search query that they're typing into the first box here would be passed to the actively running app, so Bing in this case. So the user has typed in WIND and then paused right there. In section 2, query suggestions provided by the main app on screen are displayed, and it auto-completes to terms which the app has search results for. So in this case, the Bing app has been sent the text, or has been sent the keystrokes, WIND, and in each keystroke, it's reacting and sending back query suggestions. And in this case, it is sending back suggestions of Windows Live, Windows Update, Windstream.net, and these are just results from the Bing application. In section 3 here, this is a list of installed Metro apps that have implemented the search contract. So you heard this earlier, but one really cool thing is that if your app implements the search contract, it will just show up here as a search target, and users don't have to do anything to send the query to your application. Again, if your application supports the search contract, when your app is installed from the Windows Store, Windows will actually figure out a way to display this application there. Very, very cool stuff. So what happens after that? What happens when a query is submitted? So on the left here, you'll see two scenarios. The user either enters a query and then hits search, or the user selects a query suggestion. So they type in a query, hit search, or they type in part of a query, suggestions come back, and then they say, oh, that's the one that I'm searching for, and they click on that. After that, your app is activated for search. So your app is launched with a special flag that says, a user is invoking this application for search. There are many other ways to invoke an application, too. You can simply go to the start screen, hit a tile there, and launch the application. You're not invoking the application for search in that case. You could also invoke an application for share, which I'm going to talk about in the next section. Also, the application could be activated as being coming back from being suspended. So there are all of these sort of system events that your application can pay attention to. And the one for search is that your application is activated for search. So when you add the search support to your application by adding a new item in Visual Studio, you just simply go select the solution and say add new item and then the search contract, and we wire up all the plumbing for you. That will give you the sort of backbone for paying attention to this flag that you'd pay attention to for your app to figure out if it's been activated for search. So then after that, what happens in the application? So a query submitted event will be raised, and then your application pays attention to that event. So much of Windows 8 development, Metro-style application development, and so much of Windows Phone development, for that matter, is paying attention to events and hooking up event handlers to that. It's really that simple. You can boil it down to that. So a query submitted event will be raised, and then you react to that. And you say, well, has the query changed from the last time? If it has, then you just show the new search results. So your application, in this Bing application, which I've been talking about, would say, okay, someone passed a search query of Windows to me. I'm going to go search Bing and then figure out the top 20 results for Windows or the top X results for Windows and then display them back. But if the query has not changed, then you want to show the previous search results. So you don't want to have the user invoke the search charm and then have nothing there all the time. So you want to follow the principle of least surprise so that when they invoke the search charm, they just see what they searched for previously. So, should your app integrate with search? Well, the answer is yes, if you would be building search in your app already. So use the search charm. You don't need a search box or Chrome in your app. So if your app is going to have search, just really use the contract. Use the search charm. Users will be trained and figure out that when they want to search, they're going to swipe in from the right with their thumb or hit Windows key C or use their mouse. Everyone will know about the search charm moving forward. However, you probably should not implement the search contract if your app needs a find in doc functionality, like if you have a PDF reader or an email program, and what you're actually searching for is something that's on the page. So if you had an email that was 10 pages long or a PDF that's 10 pages long, perhaps more likely, and the user is actually trying to search for something which is within that one document, then that's not a good use of the search charm in the search contract. You would just want to have a find in doc functionality instead. You might implement this like with Control F in an application, which I'm sure you're used to using right now. And also don't implement the search contract if you're a game, novelty, or utility app or something like that. So now, again, I'm going to pop back into Visual Studio and show you a code sample from the Windows Dev Center. Here's the bit.ly link if you wanted to follow along or look at this later, bit.ly/metro-interactions. Okay, again, you can download this from the Windows 8 SDK sample page. And what we do here is highlight scenario one. And then if this is a touch device, and I could swipe in from the right, but I'm just going to prove to you that you can hold down the Windows key and hit C, and that will invoke the charms also. And you hit search. And let's type in a search query here. Let's type in where we are, our venue. Club Nokia. And you should be able to see here in green underneath this box with all of the scenarios that it says activated for search with the query Club Nokia. So what I entered into the search box in the upper right-hand corner was passed over to the application. The app was activated with a flag that says, hey, someone's trying to search you, and then it pays attention to the search query and figures out what to do. So that you can get fancier with this. You can provide suggestions from an app-defined list. So in this case, let's type in the letter C here. And in this case, the sample application has a big list hard-coded into it, which is a list of the world's cities. I've typed in the letter C here. The first entry is Club Nokia, which I just searched for, so it's showing a previous search result. And then there are cities like Cairo, Chongqing, Chennai, and Cape Town. So again, there's a predefined list in the application that's being sent back. So the application is being launched with a flag that says, hey, someone's trying to search, and the application is sending back these search results. It doesn't have to, in scenario three here, you don't only have to use the Roman alphabet. You can use East Asian languages if you wish. There can be suggestions provided by Windows, from an open search engine, or from any sort of service that's providing XML. So you should download that search sample. Go to bit.ly/metrointeractions. You'll see the source code. To make the windows better. And this is the HTML and JavaScript example. And you should be able to just follow along here and see, okay, well, here's divs that are creating these controls. And here's program.js, which is going to be the meat of the application that's responding to all. I think there were five scenarios in this example. And this should be very, very easy to follow along with. So that was a search demo. No applause for that. So we covered search, and then I began with Metro-style UI controls. Let's move on to the share contract here. So there are two types. The share contract has two parts to it. There's a share source and a share target. So some apps will be sources of sharing. Some apps will be targets of sharing. So a share source might be just about any application out there that has data to share. So you can imagine a photo application or a news reading application, an RSS reader, and it has the day's news or something like this. And if a user wanted to email an article that they just read to a friend, they could mark that application as saying, this is something I want to share. Then they invoke the share contract, and then all sorts of applications that are share targets would be listed there. So with search, there's really only one kind of application that implements the search contract. With share, there are two, share source and share target. So let's talk about share source. There are things to consider as a share source app. You want to listen for and handle a share event in order to participate. Like I mentioned a few minutes ago, so much of Windows 8 application development and Windows Phone application development is paying attention to events with event handlers. So in this case, there's a share event that you want to pay attention to. So out of the box, Windows 8 will support standard formats such as plain text, rich text, HTML, URIs, images, and files. We make it very, very easy to share these things because that's going to cover much of the things that users would want to share. However, you can also create a custom data package. So don't feel like you're only limited to these things like plain text, HTML, URIs, and things like this. You can create your own data package, your own payload to share. So imagine a book. Imagine you had three different kinds of applications to share books. You had an application for libraries to organize a book collection. You had an application for users to read ebooks, like a Kindle app or a Barnes & Noble Nook app or something like this. And then imagine you had a third category of apps that were like e-commerce apps for buying books from Barnes & Noble or Amazon or wherever. Now, as long as all three of these applications agree on what a book is, they can share a book back and forth between all of these applications, and they don't need to know anything at all about each other. So down the road, 5 years from now, perhaps someone writes another ebook reader. As long as they implement the share contract for the book payload, for the book data package, which everyone has agreed upon, they'll be able to, do participate in this. And when I show some code samples, you'll see this. So the share source is trivially easy to set up. So really, there's no excuse for not doing it. And you can do share source for simple text with the code that's on the screen here. So this is JavaScript, but of course you can do this in the .NET world too, or C++ for that matter. In the very first line, you'll notice a line of JavaScript that creates a handle to the Data Transfer Manager object. It calls into the Windows runtime. The second line of code here is begins with Windows with a capital W and ends in an S, Windows, plural. So this is not window, singular, with a lowercase w, which is the JavaScript global object. So Windows, capital W with an S at the end, is how you call into the Windows runtime. So we are simply creating a handle, like I said, for a data transfer manager. And then after that, we're going to create an event listener to be called on to fill out the data package. So we add an event listener. So this would be very, very familiar to JavaScript developers. And there's a very similar way to do this in C# or Visual Basic. We pay attention to the data requested event. And then we call this anonymous callback function here. You could name this function if you wanted, but it's very common in the JavaScript world to use anonymous functions like this one here. We fill in the data package with what to share. Underneath that, you'll see a line that says var request equals e.request. So we're simply pulling the request out of the event arguments that are passed in, out of the event that's passed in. And then we set a title, description, and the actual text to share as being plain strings there. It's really that simple. Then, if a user invokes the share charm, this text will be sent to them. Let's see a demo of that. Again, I think this is the third time I've mentioned this URL, bit.ly/metro-interactions. For share source. Okay. So again, the Windows SDK has all of these samples in here, and on the left, there'll be various scenarios. So these are very common scenarios for share source. Let's just choose scenario number one here for share text. We have three lines here for the things that we're actually sharing. So when we click set here, that will set that stuff for sharing. I hit the Windows key C, and I invoke share, and I hit mail here. And you can see that the mail application, a share target application, has been sent the data from the application on the left. And if you were able to read this text here, you would see that it's the text that's been sent on the left here. So trivially easy to implement the share source example for text. And when I go back to the share contract here, you'll see that only the mail application is listed here. So this machine right here does not have a lot of apps on it. We've set this one up for today, and we've kind of made it pristine. But in the future, when many, many applications are installed and many applications know how to be share targets for plain text, they would be listed here also. So there's a WordPress application, for example, which you could set up to blog if someone wanted to blog some text or something like that. You can also share a link. You can share images. You can share files. You can do operations before sharing. So in this example, it shows you how you can delay rendering of files until someone wants to share it. So again, the share event will be raised, and then you pay attention to that. You share the data, but you can also do other things during that event handler, such as imagine you had a photo application which had lots and lots of large images, and if they're going to be shared in a mail application, they would have to be downsized, and imagine that that's computationally expensive. So you would only want to sort of downsize an image to be small enough to mail if someone actually wanted to mail that application. The point is that the share event fires, you can do that sort of computation then and actually then send the data out to be shared. Of course, HTML content can be shared, and this is the one that I like showing here. Scenario 7, custom data. So like I mentioned earlier, out of the box, Windows 8 supports sharing plain text, HTML, URIs, and things like that. Or you can create a custom data package. And here is a custom data package called a book. In this case, it's a JavaScript example, and this is a very simple JavaScript object. It mentions the type of the object, which in this case is a book, and then there are all sorts of properties. So sticking with the book analogy, imagine if one person writing a book app said, well, my idea of a book is the following. I'm going to say there's an author and a title. And what if someone else in a different part of the world decided, well, my book application is going to have properties of writer and title? Like, imagine there's another part of the world where they say writer instead of author. Could happen. So those two applications couldn't talk to each other unless they agreed upon what, unless they agreed what a book is. And luckily, there's a website called schema.org, which doesn't have anything to do with Microsoft, that defines what all of these entities are out there. And so we've all agreed upon, like the community has agreed what a book is. And if you go to that site, schema.org/book with a capital B, you'll be able to see what the community has decided a book is. And they've decided that the properties should be the name, the format, the author, the number of pages, and things like that. So the point being here, you can make your applications very rich if you implement a custom data package, but really try to pick a data package that everyone else has already agreed upon, because all of these apps work together as one and win as one. Okay, we've covered share and search contracts. I began with the MetroStyle UI controls. Now we're going to go on to notifications. So toast notifications. They're called toast notifications because they pop up like little pieces of toast from a toaster. Let's talk about some an overview of toast notifications. I know you've heard some of this before, but it bears repeating. So toast notifications deliver transient messages outside the context of the application. So the application doesn't have to be running for toast notifications to be displayed. You'll use toast notifications to get the user's attention immediately. You have some message you want to pass to the user, send them a toast. Point three, the user is in control and can permanently turn off toast notifications from your app. So if the user doesn't want to be bothered with all of these notifications, they can simply turn this off. They can turn it on later if they want. So the implication of this is that you don't want to use toast notifications for absolutely critical things that the user has to reply to or respond to. You want to get the user's attention with toast notifications, but it's not for something absolutely critical, because there's no guarantee that they'll actually see this and react to it. That's point three. Point four here allows quick navigation to a contextually relevant location in your app. When a toast notification is displayed, which we'll see in just a second, you can click on the toast and do various things there. You can just dismiss the toast, or you can bring the user to a particular point in your application. So imagine you had an email application that you were writing, and you sent a toast notification that said, a new email from someone important. The user could click on that toast notification and be brought directly to that email, and not, for example, to the inbox at large, or the last time, or the location of that you were in the last time you launched the mail application or something like this. You can bring the user to a particular point in your application. And the fifth point is really, really important. So toast notifications are easy to invoke from your app or from the cloud. So your application can send toast notifications locally on a user's device. Or there's a cloud service that we offer that can send out toast notifications to individual users on individual devices anywhere in the world. And that application doesn't need to be running at that particular time. So there are all sorts of templates that you can use for toast notifications. Here are some of them on the screen. After this, I'm going to talk about live tiles, and they also obey these, or they also can use these same templates. On the left here, you'll see plain text toast notifications, various background colors. Some of the text is bolded. You can style the text if you like. You can have custom icons that are included in the lower right corner of the four toast notifications on the left column here. And on the right column, you'll see toast notifications that include images. So you can combine images and text, plain text, rich text, with icons, images from a local machine, images from a cloud service, from online. There are really tons of templates that you can use as a starting point here. And you can find them all on dev.windows.com. Now, I mentioned that you can send toast notifications from your app that's running locally on a system, or you can use something called the Windows Push Notification Service to send toast notifications from the cloud. So the Windows Push Notification Service is a free online offering that Microsoft has that scales to hundreds of millions of devices worldwide and can send push notifications to individual users on individual devices. This is something that we offer for free. So you would combine that service with your own cloud service, which might be running in the cloud, or it might be running in your own data center, which would decide what data to actually push out. So imagine you had a sports application, a Dodgers application, and you wanted to send a toast notification that the Dodgers won or something like this. Your own service running in your own data center or on a cloud would decide, okay, send out the message, the Dodgers won, and then you do an HTTP post to the Windows push notification service, which we support, which we offer, and that will actually push out the data. So your cloud service decides what to push out. Our cloud service actually does the heavy lifting and pushes out that notification. And that's totally free, and like I mentioned, it scales to hundreds of millions of devices. It's pretty cool. You can host that part, the cloud service part that you'll be writing in your own data center, in a cloud service, but we make it very, very easy to do this from Windows Azure. And if you search for the Windows 8 toolkit for Azure, or the Windows Azure toolkit for Windows 8, I believe, you'll find a totally free framework that you can download to do toast notifications yourself. We make it very, very easy to get going on Azure. If you had another service already running in your own data center and you didn't want to use that, you're totally welcome to. But take a look at what we've done just to make it very, very easy if you like. So let's drop to Visual Studio here. Again, bit.ly/metro-interactions. And the toast sample I will run. So let's pause for a minute here while this toast sample is sitting here. And I'd like to remind you about why toasts are important. So when a user dismisses an application and it goes into the background, or it appears to go in the background, it actually is not using any system resources. So the processes and threads are not being scheduled by the kernel. It's not doing any I/O unless you've arranged to complete a long-running download or something like this. You can do certain things in the background, like play music and things like that. But in general, when your application is suspended, it's going in the background and operating, occupying memory so that someone can reactivate that application very, very quickly. However, if memory pressure increases, your application might be terminated with no notice whatsoever. The idea here is that we want to make the battery life really, really great. We want to make the user experience really, really great. And however, we don't want to have applications that just, people want to do things in the background. So the point I'm getting at here is that toasts are very, very important because they give the illusion of an application running in the background and doing something. You can send out toasts from the cloud or from your own application. You can schedule them to be delayed until a future time, things like this. It invites people to come back to your application and gives the illusion of it running in the background when your application is not actually consuming any system resources. So in this toast sample, let's highlight scenario number one and just start clicking some of these toasts. And you can see that the toasts are displayed in the upper right corner here. These are pretty basic toasts, just plain text. You can have bold text on multiple lines, various formats of toasts there. You can include images, and you also cannot flood a user with toasts. So I just hit these buttons too quickly, and it only displays three toasts at a time. So there's no way to do like a denial of service attack on a user by just sending them toast after toast after toast or something like that. That'd be really annoying. And that would be a reason that a user would disable toast, for example, for your application, which they're completely allowed to do. So text can be sent. This is just a black and white checkered flag here. You can add web images and send them to. So it doesn't have to be just images that are on a user's machine. So we could type in a URL here, or you can do this if you're doing this in the audience here or at home later on. You can type in a URL to an image and send that out as a toast notification. And you could also change the sound. So there's a sort of chirp that happens when you get a toast notification. You can change the sound to be many other things here too. Those are toast notifications. Again, you can download this from bit.ly/metro-interactions, which is the title of this talk in case you don't remember. And take a look at the source code for it yourself. Cut and paste the source code that you see. And you don't have to spend a whole lot of time learning how to do this because we've done a lot of it for you. So just take a look at all of this stuff here. Cut and paste it into your application. So those were toast notifications. So now let's talk about live tiles. So toast notifications go hand in hand with live tiles. So they both give the illusion of your application running in the background. So you'll want to make your app alive with activity using tiles and notifications. Here's a really engaging start screen. So this person has put a lot of effort into customizing their start screen, and they've made it very, very personal to them. Let's walk through some of the live tiles here. In the upper left, you'll see a photograph, possibly of the daughter of the person whose start screen this is. Below that, you'll see a photograph on the left and then four smaller photographs on the right. So don't feel like you're limited to just one giant photograph. There are all sorts of collages of photographs that you can put together, collages of images that you can put together by looking at the templates which are in the Windows Dev Center. And below that is an image with some text below it. There's a surfer, and then below that there's text that reads, "First ever surfboard kickflip recorded in Santa Cruz." Also take a look at the lower right-hand corner of these live tiles here, and you'll see glyphs and numbers. So you can send a glyph or number up to 99 as a live tile notification to users. And in the right, you'll see icons for the application. So these live tiles can be animated there. So I hope everyone just paid attention as I was flicking going through that, and I'll do that one more time. So there's, five live tiles there that were just animated. So you can go back and forth between a full screen image and text. And again, there are lots of templates here, and these animations are called peaks. So think of a way to make your application alive with activity. And why would you want to do this? Because you want to give the illusion of running in the background, like I've been saying, but you also want to entice users to actually run your application. The more times people run your application, the more money in your pocket, for example, if you've charged for the app, or maybe you're displaying advertisements as a way to make money in your application. Of course, I need to run your application to display the advertisements. So this is what live tiles are all about. So out of the box, we give you a basic tile, and a user just taps on the tile to launch your application. That's pretty self-explanatory. And if you do File, New Project in Visual Studio, you can take a look at the application manifest, and you'll see what tile is specified right there out of the box. A static tile is what you get out of the box. So there are two sizes, a square tile or a wide tile, and the user can choose back and forth, can switch back and forth between these two tile sizes if they like. And both tiles can have live updates, which I've just shown there. The square one and the wide one can both have live updates. As I mentioned when I was showing the entire start screen, you can have a status that displays on top of the live tile. So you can send numbers up to 99 or a predefined glyph, and these are called badges. In the lower right-hand corner, the glyph or the badge will be displayed. A number up to 99 for perhaps like unread email messages or new tweets that have come in since the last time you launched the application or something like this. Or you can send glyphs. So let's pull up a demo of live tiles on bit.ly/metro interactions. Right. So what I would like to do first is go to the start screen, and you can see here is the application that I just launched. It's called Windows SDK Sample, and there's nothing on that live tile. It's a static tile. It's not a live tile. It just simply says Windows SDK Sample. I'm going to drag this tile over here to the left just so that I don't need to always scroll to the right side of the screen, because I'm going to be going back and forth between Visual Studio and the live tile right now. So let's send a tile notification with text. So just click that, and here's the output, which will simply say, "Hello world, my very own tile notification." So plain text has been sent to the live tile. Now when we go back, you'll see that this live tile here has changed to, "Hello world, my very own tile notification." So this is an example of sending a live tile notification from the app that's running natively on this machine here. And again, you can send live tile notifications from a cloud service. We handle the plumbing for you, and you can hook up your own cloud service in your own data center or in the cloud that describes what information that you actually want to send out. So you can also send a live tile notification with local images. So that's scenario two. We'll drop back here. And here's an image which is simply just an image of a red rectangle. Not too exciting. You can pass in images from a web service. So you could type in a URL of an image here and send that as a live tile update. You can send badge notifications. Let's send a number. Someone call out a number.
12.
I heard 12. Send the badge notification. So you see how that just popped up right there? The lower right corner of the number 12. So you can, again, send this from the application running on your system here, or you can do it from a cloud service. There are lots and lots of templates, like I've been mentioning, for live tile notifications or for toast notifications, which I covered in the previous section. Lots of them. So you'll find these on the Windows Dev Center. You can just scroll through them. There's like three or four different screenfuls of these templates right here. You can cycle through notifications if you like. You can also send a notification that will expire. So imagine you had an e-commerce application and you wanted to send a live tile notification to a user that offered them a coupon, but only for a day or something like this. Like today only 10% off at some restaurant or something like that. You could send out a live tile notification and there, on their start screen, they would see a message that said, hey, 10% off today. And then they would click your application and run it and get the coupon and go out and shop there. But you don't want that coupon to be there forever. You would say expire in 24 hours or something like this. So this is a way to give notifications to users besides just putting them in, sending messages in their inbox. So I probably, like many people in the audience, use a lot of those daily deal websites and they're sending you email all the time and it really come, there's a lot of them, right? A lot of these come and I don't read them all. But I'm always looking at my start screen, for example. So if I had a daily deal application that could send out an interesting daily deal, I would see it right away. And somehow I feel like that's less of a burden for me to get over and to find out what the daily deal is, besides launching a mail application and reading an email there, for example. But you might want to have it expire. You can send images, and these can be localized for various parts of the world. So you don't just want to send out English, for example, although that will reach a lot of people. Maybe you want to do something in Latin America and send out Spanish or Portuguese or something like that. So that was coding live tiles. So what are the next steps here? So we've been mentioning all day that there's this Windows Dev Center, dev.windows.com. There you will find the samples SDK. I would download the entire 200 or 300 megabyte samples, and they'll be on your machine forever, and just go through them and find interesting ones to you. You can also pick out individual samples. For example, as I mentioned earlier, there was a guy interested in the date picker control. So you could go to dev.windows.com, look for the samples, and type in date picker, and you'll get a very small code sample which just shows you specifically how to do the date picker. Copy that into your own application and you're off and running. There are, this link again was bit.ly/metro interactions. So I would really encourage you to download these samples and kick the tires and run through them on your own. And then you'll also want to think about how to incorporate these metro interactions in your app. So in the previous section, which Jeremy did, he planted, I hope, seeds in your mind about what kind of application you want to be writing. So I hope you're all thinking about what kind of application you'd like to write. After dinner, we'll be building the Contoso Cookbook application, which Alice Pang demoed earlier. We've all done that same application, and trust me, it's really the best way to learn how to do all of this, is go through the labs. It's guided labs, and we teach you how to build this application from the ground up. You can read blog after blog or see video after video, but until you do a hands-on lab like that, it's not going to fully sink in. That was my experience. So I hope you have an idea for an application. The next step would be to think about how to incorporate these metro interactions into your application. Search, share, the UI controls, live tile updates, and toast notifications, because these are the hallmarks of Windows 8 metro style applications, and these are the things that set our platform apart from everyone else's. So you want your applications to not run as silos, you want your applications to talk to each other. You want your applications to be search targets, because people will be searching all along, all the time, and you might as well get that traffic. So with that, I pass it back to Scott for a quick announcement, and thanks for your attention.